I had the privilege of serving in New Jersey in the early part of the 80s. The latter part of the 80s. It was 84 to 89 was when I worked in New Jersey. And about the second year that I was there, I saw an item in the newspaper. It was written by a Mayo Clinic doctor. And it stated that Christ died of a broken heart. And I was emblazoned by that. I just about came apart when I saw that. Christ died of a broken heart. You know, that comes from the idea that the way that the scriptures state that the guard used a lance and pierced his side and out came water and blood after he was already dead. And that's what made me so angry about that. If that were the case, your sacrifice is worthless. Isn't it? You'd be in a dead sacrifice and some blood. It could very well have been the blood of the goats like it always was a representation of before. And been just as good if that were the case. No, Jesus Christ shed his blood. His life, if you please. The life is in the blood. He shed his life so that our sins can be forgiven. And I was really upset by that when I heard that. And I had to give a sermon up there about that right off at the top. I think it was almost like the one I gave here the last time. Extemporaneous, you know. I just got up and started talking about that. But I want to turn to Hebrews, the 11th chapter at the beginning here. The 9th chapter of Hebrews, what I want. If I would look at my notes, hadn't I? Hebrews 9 and verse 11, that's what I want. But Christ came as high priest of the good things to come, which are greater and more perfect tabernacle, not made with hands, that is, not of this creation, not with the blood of goats and calves, but with his own blood. He came with his own blood? Well, if he came with his blood, he was alive. Obviously. He came with his own blood. He entered the most holy place once for all, having obtained eternal redemption. For if the blood of bulls and goats and the ashes of a heifer sprinkling the unclean sanctifies with the purifying of the flesh, how much more shall the blood of Christ, who through the eternal Spirit offered himself with his blood, obviously, he offered himself without spot to God, cleanse your conscience and dead works to serve the living God. I could turn to other places about that. In fact, maybe I should just point out another rather interesting technicality. Go to Romans, the third chapter, and verse 5, I believe, what I want, or verse 15. I'll have to see for sure. Maybe it's verse 25, who was delivered up because of our offenses, who was raised because of our justification. No, that isn't the verse I wanted exactly, but maybe did I get the right chapter? I don't know. Oh, I'm reading in verse, and no wonder I had the wrong, I was looking at the wrong one. Yeah, it's verse 25 of chapter 3, if I read it correctly. It says, whom God set forth as propitiation for our blood, by his blood. The propitiation means the means by which sins can be forgiven. That's what that word meant. Now, there that word propitiation is used several times, but only twice is it ever used by using the word that is used here. And the other time that it is used is in Hebrews, the 9th chapter and verse 5, I believe it is. Yes, Hebrews 9 and verse 5. You might hold that one and turn there. Hebrews 9 and verse 5 says, and above it were the cherubim, where the Apostle Paul here is describing. I'm convinced the Apostle Paul wrote this in Hebrews, even though there is some controversy in the higher critics about it. But above it were the cherubim of glory overshadowing the mercy seat. That word mercy, those words mercy seat, is the only second time, along with Romans 3:5, that same word in the Greek language is used twice in the New Testament. The mercy seat. Thank God for His mercy. That was the means by which they could be forgiven symbolically, even in the Old Testament times. And the propitiation is, as it is used over in Romans 3 and verse 25, literally means, and I even have a marginal reference in my New King James Bible that says mercy seat, same as the Old Testament when they went to the mercy seat for forgiveness. I just wanted to mention that in going across this. Today, I want to talk about the only one sign of the Messiah that the Messiah gave, of His resurrection, of His death and resurrection. And I think all of you know that the subject is the 3 days and three nights. I want to talk about that in Matthew, the 12th chapter, Matthew chapter 12 and verse 38. I have that correct. Matthew 12 and verse 38, then some of the scribes and Pharisees answered, saying, Teacher, we want to see a sign. What? He had been there and had healed many, many people. He had done all kinds of miraculous things. Now they say, but we want to see a sign. You know, it's really ridiculous when you think of it that way. We want to see a sign of you. But he said, when he answered and said unto them, an evil and adulterous generation seeks after a sign. Who was it that was asking for a sign? An evil and adulterous generation. That's what he just told them straight out. An evil and adulterous generation seeks after a sign, and no sign will be given to it except the sign of the prophet Jonah. For as Jonah was 3 days and three nights in the belly of the great fish, so will the Son of Man be 3 days and three nights in the heart of the earth. So he was 3 days and three nights from the time the tomb was closed until he was resurrected. 3 days and three nights. Now, it's ironic to me that as far as I know, I can't find any of the commentaries that ever question Jonah's 3 days and three nights as equal to 72 hours. 3 days and three nights. It's incredible to me. Let's turn to Jonah and just see that passage. It's Jonah 1 and verse 17. Jonah 1 and verse 17, which says, Now the Lord had prepared a great fish. Oh, say, that was some fish he prepared. He prepared some fish here. He prepared a great fish to swallow Jonah. A fish could swallow Jonah? Can you even think of a circumstance where any kind of a creature, I don't care what it is, could swallow a man, and he could live for 3 days and three nights in the gastric juices of a critter, that would be absolutely ridiculous. This was some fish that God created for Jonah. Now, I know there's always been arguments about, and they say, well, a whale swallowed him. A whale can't swallow a man if it wanted to. It just don't have the passage, throat passage to do it. But this was a fish that God created, and he lived there for 3 days and three nights in the belly of the fish, 3 days and three nights. As I said, as far as I know, nobody ever questions that particular scripture. Why then don't they believe Jesus when he said that he would be 3 days and three nights in the heart of the earth? Well, in order to go through an explanation of that, I want to start with the historic setting. And I want to do that by going to Daniel, the 9th chapter. Daniel chapter 9, and show what Daniel said, what God inspired him to say, in verse 24, Daniel 9 and verse 24 and 25. Daniel says, 70 weeks are determined for your people and for the holy city to finish the transgression. Now, the only way the transgression can be finished or paid for or however you wish to play it is by Jesus Christ paying the penalty, and then we can be forgiven for it. To finish the transgression, to make an end of sins. As I said, the only way sins end is for them to be paid for, and Jesus Christ paid the penalty. To make reconciliation for iniquity, to bring an everlasting righteousness, to seal up vision and prophecy, and to anoint the Most Holy. Now, we know who the Most Holy is that came, and that was Jesus Christ coming. So, 70 weeks are determined. Now, let's get that a little more correctly stated as we go on here. It says, know therefore and understand that from the going forth of the command to restore and build the temple in Jerusalem? No, it doesn't say that. In order to build Jerusalem until Messiah, the Prince, from the time that the call goes forth then, from the time of the going forth of the command to restore to build Jerusalem to the time of the Messiah until the Prince, there will be 7 weeks and 62 weeks. 62 and 7 is 69. I have enough mathematics behind me that I can figure that out all by myself. 69 weeks. Prophetically, when we speak of prophecies, a week, a day for a year. That's Ezekiel 4:6, if you want to see the scriptures for that, and Numbers 14:34. I said it, now I got to have to look. Numbers 14:34, I think, is the... I'll look it up for sure so that I get it right. Numbers 14:34. According to the number of days which you spied out the land, 40 days, for each day you shall bear your guilt 1 year. A day for a year. 40 days they spied out the land, and they stayed in the wilderness for 40 years. In prophecy, a day for a year then, and Daniel was speaking in prophetic terms over here when he said there would be 7 weeks and 62 weeks after the command goes out to the time of the Messiah. And it said even in troublesome times. Then drop down to verse 27. It says, then he shall confirm a covenant with many for 1 week. That was prophecy. How much is 1 week of years? 7 years, obviously. He shall confirm a covenant with many for 1 week. And in the middle of the week, he shall bring an end to the sacrifice and offerings. To bring an end to the sacrifice and offerings means that he had to die to pay for the sins of the world and to fulfill the meaning of all of those blood sacrifices that they kept down through all of the ages, all of the time. And he put an end to all of those sacrifices. And on the wing of abomination shall be one who makes desolate, even unto the consummation which is determined, is poured out on the desolate. Now, that is a very interesting prophecy, because if we look at it from the time that the command went forth to build Jerusalem, when was that? Well, it was in Artaxerxes, if I can even say it correctly, Artaxerxes' time in his seventh year. Let's turn to that and see it. In Ezra, the seventh chapter, I believe is what I want. Where is the little book of Ezra? Oh, it's in here. Ezra 7. And I want to start in verse 7. Ezra 7 and verse 7. Some of the children of Israel, the priests, the Levites, the singers, the gatekeepers, and the Nethinim came up to Jerusalem when? In the seventh year of King Artaxerxes. And that was what Daniel was referring to when he said that this was the time that the command went forth. And Ezra came to Jerusalem in the fifth month, which is in the seventh year of the king. On the first day of the first month, he began his journey from Babylon, and on the first day of the fifth month, he came to Jerusalem according to the good hand of God upon him. For Ezra, verse 10 says, Ezra prepared his heart to seek the law of the Lord and to do it. Ezra was well versed in the Mosaic laws and the laws that God set down in the original Old Covenant. And to do it and to teach statutes and ordinances in Israel. Now, verse 11. This is a copy of the letter. This is a copy of the letter that King Artaxerxes gave Ezra, the priest, the scribe, expert in the words of the commandments and the Lord, and of his statutes in Israel. And Artaxerxes, verse 12, says that the king wrote to Ezra the priest, the scribe, and so forth. And then here's the copy of the whole letter. I don't want to read it, but there is the command that went forth to build Jerusalem. That time, Ezra and the party went to Jerusalem. Now, I know if you start studying this in commentaries, you'll come up with about three other possible explanations for this time that the command went forth. And none of them really match. None of them really follow. So I'm not even going to fuss with that, because I got more than I want to spend on time here on this without backing up to that kind of stuff. This is the command. And this command was given in 457 B.C. How do I say that? Any time from about 1000 B.C. down, see, historians have been able to nail things down so accurately in history that they do this by signs in the heavens, you know, eclipses and things of this nature. They pin them down to actual events so that historically the dates that are given as far back as Artaxerxes' time in Persia are very accurate. 457 B.C. was the time that this command went forth. And history is quite accurate on all of that. Now, 62 weeks and 7 weeks of prophecy, how much is that? 62 weeks and 7 weeks would turn out to be 483 if you multiplied it by 7. The 69 by 7. 483. Now, Again, as I said, I've had enough mathematics that I can subtract 457 from 483, and if you do that, you come out with 26. So, 483 years after 457 BC brings us to 26 AD by calculation. However, there's a one little hitch in that calculation. When they counted down from BC to AD, they counted 2 BC, 1 BC, 1 AD, 2 AD, and so forth. No year zero. Therefore, instead of counting 2, 1, 0, 1, 2, and 3, there's a year missing in there. So you have to add a year. So it comes out to 27 AD instead of 26 AD. The very time that Jesus Christ began his ministry, when he came as his ministry. If you turn to Luke, the third chapter, Luke chapter 3, and verse 23, I believe, is the one I want. Luke chapter 3 and verse 23. See if I'm right on that. I finally found it. It says, now Jesus himself began his ministry at about 30 years of age, being, as was supposed, the son of Joseph, the son of Heli, etc., etc., on down. I won't go into all of that, but he was 30 years of age when he began his ministry. Therefore, he was born 4 BC. Again, for no year zero, see, if you calculate them out across. And he started his ministry in 27 AD. And if he started his ministry in 27 AD, he was to make that covenant for 1 week. 1 week of years is 7 years. And he was cut off in the middle of the week, 3.5 years. Now everybody knows that. What happened to the other 3.5 years? If you have the answer, you know better than I do, because it is not yet fulfilled. If I understand it at all, it's not yet fulfilled. That other 3.5 years has yet to come. And that's not my subject today, so I'm going to pass that up. But I want to dwell on that matter of in the middle of the week, because that gets important. That prophecy was so intricate in Daniel, the 9th chapter in verse 27. I should have told you to save your place there, and we'll go back to it. But it says, then he shall confirm the covenant with many for 1 week, but in the middle of the week. Now, the middle of the prophetic week, and, if you please, the middle of a week. What is the day in the middle of the week? Well, you have, if you have the middle of the week, you got 7 days. You have 1, 2, 3 on one side, and then you have 5, 6, 7 on the other side. The fourth day is the middle of the week, which is what we call Wednesday. And that's when he was cut off. By that very prophecy. It's beautiful when you put the pieces together, only way they'll fit correctly. You see, in that 3 days and 3 nights. I quoted Luke 3:23 about the time that Jesus started his ministry, but now I want to go into that 3 days and 3 nights business. And if you get this, you will never, ever again be worried about 3 days and 3 nights in the heart of the tomb. Mark 15. Mark chapter 15. And what verse do I want? Verse 33. Mark chapter 15 and verse 33. Where it says, now at this time, the setting here in Mark is where Jesus was already on the cross, as it says in verse 32. the cross or stake or whatever. I'm not going to argue that thing because it makes no difference to me. The Romans had two different ways of doing it at that time, and one was a stake and the other was a cross anyway. But that's neither here nor there. Verse 33. Now when the sixth hour had come, the sixth hour starts from sunup. When you start counting from sunup, they counted normally from 6 a.m. If you count from 6 a.m., 6 hours, it takes you down to 12, noon. And that's approximately what this time was. Now, when the sixth hour had come, about noon in our reckoning, there was darkness over the whole land until the ninth hour. Now, the ninth hour then would be about 3 p.m. Darkness over the whole land? What day was this? What were the Jews doing at this time? Well, this was the preparation day for their Seder meal that very night. They had to prepare their lamb for the Seder meal and all of the rest of the accoutrements for the Seder meal. And then suddenly it's black for 3 hours right after noon. That wasn't the most pleasant thing for them, probably. They had to turn on all their electric lights and everything about that. Now, I don't mean they didn't have any lights. They probably had different kind of lights. They didn't have lights like we have. I'm quite sure about that, too. But when we find out what kind of lights they had, it may dumbfound us, however. But that's neither here nor there either at that moment. But it was a crux, shall we say, a real problem, because 3 hours it was black. And then verse 34. And at the ninth hour, Jesus cried out with a loud voice, saying, "Eloi, Eloi, lama sabachthani," which is translated, "My God, my God, why have you forsaken me?" Had to be translated because he quoted it in Hebrew. The "Eloi, Eloi, lama sabachthani" is in Hebrew, and he had to translate it into the language in which he was writing, probably the Greek, undoubtedly. It was written in Greek. And verse 35 says, some of those who were standing by when they heard that looked, he's calling for Elijah. Verse 36, and someone ran and filled a sponge full of sour wine. Well, when wine goes sour, it turns into vinegar, you know. That's what it amounts to. It was full of sour wine, but put it on a reed and offered it to him to drink, saying, let him alone and see if Elijah will come to take him down. And Jesus cried out with a loud voice and breathed his last. He died. How did he die? It doesn't tell you there. You notice it doesn't tell you there how he died, actually. I'll turn to Luke's version of that, Luke 23, just to see parallel, actually, nearly. Luke 23, verse 44, nearly parallel passage of it, Luke's way of stating it, where he says, now it was about the sixth hour, and there was darkness over the earth until the ninth hour. Then the sun was darkened, and the veil of the temple was torn in two. That would be worth a sermon in itself, but I won't stop on that veil of the temple. And when Jesus had cried out with a loud voice, he said, Father, into your hands I commit my spirit. Having said this, he breathed his last. Doesn't tell you how he died. He just died. Is that right? Well, there's a little more to the story, brethren. And even the translators have followed us up somewhat on that. And I want to show you that today, if you never get anything else out of this sermon. In John, the 19th chapter, let's go to that one. Might as well hit the bad part first, you know, the heaviest part first. Then I'll explain this stuff to you. In John 19, in verse 31, I believe that's what I want first. John 19, 31. Therefore, because it was the preparation day. Now, you see, I could have read verses 29 and 30 where Jesus had received the sour wine, he said, is finished, and he bowed his head and gave up the spirit. Therefore, verse 31 says, therefore it was the preparation day. Preparation for what? Preparation for the high day, for the holy day of the first day of unleavened bread. In other words, this was Nisan 15, if you want the date on it, as far as the calendar they used is concerned. Therefore, because it was the preparation day, that the body should not remain on the cross on the Sabbath, for that Sabbath was a high day, not the Sabbath of the commandment. It was a high day Sabbath, and the Jews and Pilate asked Pilate that their legs might be broken, that they might be taken away, because they didn't want the bodies to remain on the torture stake during the Sabbath. Then the soldiers came and broke the legs of the first and the other that was crucified with him. But when they came to Jesus, they saw that he was already dead. They did not break his legs. Not a bone in his body was broken, Psalm says. Why did they break their legs? Well, hanging on a cross like that, well, if you break their legs, they don't have any support under them. And they just pull down and choke. They just choke and die. Excuse the gory part, but that's just the way it was. Sorry about that, but that was why they broke their legs. But Jesus was already dead. What happened to him? Well, let's go on. But verse 34. But one of the soldiers pierced his side with a spear, and immediately blood and water came out. It sounds like he was already dead whenever they pierced him, doesn't it? You see what I said the translators have done to us? Now, even worse than that, they left out one verse. And the ironic part of this that really, I never could understand how they ever really did this, but they used the Alexandrian manuscript, which is basically the best, oldest manuscript available. And I might say the oldest, also the oldest known manuscript. They used that to translate the King James, the King 1611 King James Bible, and they left this verse out. I want to show you that. Matthew 28. Let's go to that one. Pardon me, Matthew 27. Let's try that instead. If I look at my notes, I can follow it, maybe. Matthew 27. And I think I'll start about verse 45. Here it says, now from the sixth hour to the ninth, there was darkness all over the land. We read that in two other already. And in the ninth hour, Jesus cried with a loud voice, saying, Eli, Eli, lama sabachthani, that is, my God, why have you forsaken me? It had to be translated again because it was spoken originally in Hebrew. Now, some of those that stood there, when they heard that, said, this man is calling for Elijah. Immediately, one of them ran and took a sponge, filled it with sour wine, and put it on a reed and offered to him to drink. And the rest said, let him alone. Let us see if Elijah will come to save him. And there's a part missing right there. I'm going to show you that. And Jesus cried again with a loud voice, verse 50 says, and yielded up the spirit. Now, I think most of you have probably read the booklets on 3 days and three nights, and the resurrection was not on Sunday, and most of that stuff. And you also know from most of you that have known Mr. Armstrong's writings from the past, and I have to realize that a lot of you don't do that either, because he's been dead now for quite a number of years, you know, but almost 20 years, 19 years, and that's a long time. But he used the Moffat translation of the Bible pretty liberally in his day. And let's turn to that verse, Matthew 27. And I will start reading there where I did in verse 45. Matthew 27 and verse 45 out of Moffat translation. It says, now from 12 o'clock to 3 o'clock, darkness covered all the land. He doesn't bother to say the sixth to the ninth hour. He just says 12 o'clock to 6 o'clock all over the land. And about 3 o'clock, Jesus gave a loud cry, Eli, Eli, lama sabachthani, that is, my God, why have you forsaken me? On hearing this, verse 47 says, some of the bystanders said, he's calling for Elijah. One of them, verse 48, ran at once and took a sponge. And when he soaked it in vinegar, he put it at the end of a stick and gave it to him to drink. Verse 49. Now, let's get it right this time. But the other said, stop. Let's see if Elijah will come to save him. Seizing a lance, another pricked his side, and out came water and blood. Jesus again uttered a loud scream and gave up his spirit. They left that part out of how he actually was killed by the seizing of a lance. But then how is it that John translates that over there that way, the way he does? Very interesting also to see how John translates that over there. Now, I'll turn back to it just to get it in the King James as it states. John 19 and verse 34 is what I want. John chapter 19 and verse 34. I'll just read that verse again. I read them before here, but it says, but one of the soldiers pierced his side with a spear, and immediately blood and water came out. Oh, I passed up something. I got to back up farther than that. Back up to verse 32. I read verse 31 where it was the high day of the preparation day for the feast. Verse 32 says, then the soldiers came and broke the legs of the first and the second, the other that was crucified with him. But when they came to Jesus, they saw that he was already dead. They did not break his legs. Verse 34, one of the soldiers pierced his side. It sounds like he did it after he was dead. That's the way they made it sound. You know why? In my 42 years in the ministry, I've had the privilege of dealing with a lot of people. And one of the men that I got well acquainted with, dealt with him, visited with him many, many times, was a man that was educated in the Greek language. He came from Greece and was educated in the Greek language. And he told me, he said, when you start talking about tenses in the Greek language verbs, you've got a problem over here. He said, in the Greek language, there are about 27 different tenses that you can have. You know, we have the past tense, the present tense, the past tense, and the future tense, whatever, how should I say it. And then the present participle, past participle, etc. About 6 of them or something like that. Instead of that, they have about 27 different variations of tenses in the verbs. Now, the translators had a little problem here. And I brought along this Harmony of the Gospels. I don't know how many of you ever even heard of this one, but Fred Kohler wrote this. He was one of our ministers in the Worldwide Church of God years ago. I knew the man quite well myself, but he wrote this Harmony of the Gospels, and in doing it, he used what is called the Stephen's Received Text of the Bible, of the New Testament. And I want to read Stephen's text in this verse here of John 19. And I started in verse 31. I'll just read it again here in this received text. Verse 31. Then the Jews, in order that the bodies might remain on the cross on, should not remain on the cross on the Sabbath, because it was the preparation day, since the coming Sabbath was the great day, the holy day, the first day of unleavened bread, they requested of Pilate that their legs might be broken and their bodies be taken away. Verse 32, therefore the soldiers came and broke the first one's legs and the legs of the second, who was crucified with him. But when they came to Jesus, they saw he was already dead, and they did not break his legs. Verse 34, rather, one of the soldiers had already pierced his side with a spear. Now, it fits together with Matthew 27:49, where he was pierced. They left that verse out, and they make it sound like it's past tense in John, the King James Version of the Bible, and it's not right. The Alexandrian text, I want to read this to you, but that's why I brought this book. It says, he had already pierced his side with a spear, and immediately blood and water came out. Let's see. He had actually seen it, borne witness and testified of that this is actually true. Now, I want to point out, Matthew 27:49 in this version also, in this Stephen's text. I'll read verse 48, and no use reading all of that over again. It says, and immediately someone ran and took a sponge and filled it with vinegar and put it on a stick and gave him to drink. But the rest said, let him alone, let's see if Elijah comes to save him. And another took a spear and thrust it into his side, and out came water and blood. And then Jesus yelled out again with a loud voice and yielded up the spirit. Now there's a little asterisk there, a footnote, and I want to read this footnote to you in this one, because he did some homework on this. I'll say that about Fred Coulter on here, because it says here in this asterisk, that last portion of this verse, of verse 49, and he quotes it, quote, and another took a spear and thrust it in his side, and out came water and blood, unquote, has been left out of the King James Version. This is unfortunate. However, the greater part of the ancient manuscripts do confirm the entire verse. The greater part of all of the oldest of manuscripts, the most authentic. And then he names them. He says, namely, the Codex Vaticanus, which is one of the very authentic ones, and the Sinaitica. That's the one that primarily was used to translate the King James anyway, if you know the history of it, which are the two of the most ancient manuscripts. It is found complete in a number of other manuscripts, which are designated by letters only, and then he names them, L, T, Z, and other designated by numbers 33, 49, 892, and 1,241. If he searched all of those manuscripts, he did some homework before he put this all down. And I wanted to read that to you. See, it proves irrefutably that verse was really left out. That part of that verse was left out of the King James. He goes on to say, also Moffat contains the complete verse as well as the Fenton translation. And most of the more recent translations contain the entire verse. But footnote the missing section. A lot of them do that. Now the Revised Standard Version has a footnote pointing this out also, which I found rather interesting. It didn't use the Alexandrian manuscript, but it is a very quite accurate translation anyway, the Revised Standard Version. But it has a footnote showing that that verse was left out. I wanted to show that to you because I think it's good that we realize that this 3 days and three nights thing that is taught is used from the King James Version of the Bible primarily. I believed it all my young life. And I was serious about it. I really thought I was right. Unfortunately, I was seriously wrong, and I didn't know that then until I had to study it myself, because I always had questions in my mind about how can you squeeze 3 days and three nights in Friday night till Sunday morning? And then they talk about the daylight part of the day yet on top of all of that, Sunday, even to squeeze that in. Well, let's look at that too. There's another verse I wanted to point out, and that's Matthew 28 and verse 1. Matthew 28 and verse 1. It says, now after the Sabbath, as the first day of the week began to dawn, Mary Magdalene and the other Mary came to see the tomb. Now it's interesting, because that word Sabbath, Mr. Armstrong pointed this out many, many years ago. That word is a plural. After the Sabbath, plural. Two of them had to be more than one, plural. After the Sabbath. Well, sure there was. There was a Sabbath on the fifth day of the week, a fifth day of that week, and there was a Sabbath in the seventh day of the week. Two Sabbaths. The day in between was a normal work day. We call it Thursday and Saturday, and then Friday was the day in between, which was just a normal work day. I think it's important that we recognize that. You see, again, that one is left out. I don't know if I have that in this King, in this revised text, but I think it would show here also, if I could find it. Don't know if I can for sure. Yeah. Let me read this one. I find that very interesting. In the Stevens text, you see, he knows that there was 3 days and three nights. It says, now late after the two Sabbaths. Late after the two Sabbaths. After reading this out of Stephen's text now. The first holy day during the Feast of Unleavened Bread and the weekly Sabbath, as it was getting light toward the first day of the week, Mary Magdalene and the other Mary came to see the sepulchre. Now, I wanted to point that out because, again, it helps us to understand, and there are two verses that I want you to get. Please understand that if you get these two passages in mind, you will never, ever be troubled with that 3 days and three nights again. That's Mark 15, 47 to, Mark 15, 47 to 16, verse 2. Let's read that passage. 15:47 in Mark. It says, Mary Magdalene and Mary the mother of Joseph observed where he was laid. And chapter 16 and verse 1, and says, when the Sabbath was passed. Well, what Sabbath is this? It's not the Sabbath of the commandment. This is the high day Sabbath, Nisan 15, if you please. That's the holy day Sabbath, Mary Magdalene, and you see, when the Sabbath was passed, Mary Magdalene and the mother of Salome bought spices. When did they buy spices? Well, they didn't go out and buy spices after they watched him laid in the tomb, because that was right at the sundown exactly. Right at there were no stores open anymore after that. They couldn't go buy spices after that. It had to be the next day, the only way it could be. So they bought spices that they might come and anoint him. And very early in the morning on the first day of the week. Oh. Now we come to the first day of the week. So, you see, we went from Nisan 15 on that Sabbath when it was passed, while they bought spices, and then early on the next morning, that would be Nisan 18, actually, by early in the morning. Now let's go over to the other and sort of clinch this tightly together. Luke 23 and verse 55. The women who had come with him from Galilee followed after, and they observed the tomb and how his body was laid. Now they observed it right up to the time that the stone was rolled in, which was right at sundown. And they didn't go by anything after that. Not in that day, I mean. Not that day. Then they returned and prepared spices. Oh, when did they do that? Well, they had to do it after that 15-day Sabbath then. And fragrant oils. And they rested on the Sabbath. What Sabbath? Well, read it. On the Sabbath according to the commandments. What's the Sabbath according to the commandment? Well, you can say it. Exodus 20 and verse 8. Remember the Sabbath day to keep it holy. 6 days you shall labor, and the seventh day is the Sabbath in the commandment, if you please. That's the Sabbath of the commandment. So that was the seventh day Sabbath that they rested. Now, on the first day of the week, right after that seventh day Sabbath, very early in the morning, this is chapter 24 and verse 1, very early in the morning, they came, and certain other women with them, and came to the tomb bringing the spices which they had prepared, but they found the stone rolled away already. Now, how early was this? It says it was very early in the morning. Now, let's knock that three days and three nights being squeezed into Friday night, sunset to Sunday morning, right in the head. Go over to John, the 20th chapter. John chapter 20. And again, I'm not here to refute all that the other churches teach us. That's not my purpose at all. I just want to look at the right side. I want to look at the right way. The right way it should be. John 20 and verse 1. Now, on the first day of the week, this was Nisan 18, if you calculate out the days, Nisan 15 being on Thursday, 16th on Friday, 17th was the Sabbath, then the 18th was the day after the Sabbath, the first day of the week. First day of the week, Mary Magdalene went unto the tomb early while it was still dark. So dark they couldn't even recognize one another. There was no daytime part of this. His clothes were already wrapped and placed in place and already there when they went out there. And it was very early in the morning. So he had been resurrected already before that. 3 days and three nights, he said, would be the one and only sign. Well, the tomb was closed right at the beginning of the Sabbath of the Nisan 15, the start of Nisan 15. The night of Nisan 15 and the day part would be one day. The night part of the 16th and the day part of the 16th would be 2 days. The night part of the 17th is the Sabbath, and the day part of that 17th would be 3 days and three nights. He was resurrected then right after the Sabbath of the weekly Sabbath, that is, the Sabbath of the commandment. And that filled up 3 days and three nights, and it's the only way all of the pieces will fit together, if you really want to put them all together. Otherwise, you've got questions that come up all over the place about how this all happened, just like I did all the way from childhood. I never could figure this out. It wasn't that I wouldn't believe them, but I thought, well, these are educated people, you know. They know what they're talking about. Yeah, I guess they did. I thought I didn't know what I was talking about, so I had to study it a little bit, and then I found out what I was talking about, see. But if you get those facts down, actually, you will never again have any problem with that 3 days and three nights that he was in the heart of the earth, that he was in the tomb. And it was the very one sign that he said he would give of that the Jews asked for, a sign. And he said that was the one sign that he would give them.